B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Wednesday, October 4th, 2017. I'll confess, it's been a tough day here at the Secret Studio. I've had computer problems, recorded a great interview, and it appears the computer has destroyed it. But we shall press on and hope that this podcast comes through technically and I can deliver it to you. So Rexxon Tillerson, the Secretary of State with no experience in the diplomatic arena, clearly has been struggling in his job. And it doesn't help when his boss, Donald Trump, undercuts him with public statements, with wacky policies like his speech at the UN where he attacked North Korea, and also inferred that he's going to pull the United States out of the six-party Iranian nuclear deal. And NBC News has published a piece that Trump says they should apologize for and retract. And in it, they declared that based on sources they've talked to, that Rex Tillerson, the former Exxon boss, threatened to quit over the summer, and that at one point had to be talked down by Vice President Mike Pence. NBC also reported that in a conversation after a meeting at the Pentagon, talking about Trump's bluffing and bullying, he apparently referred to his boss, the president, as a moron. And in a news conference that was hastily called in Washington today by the Secretary of State, he went out of his way to dismiss these claims, except for the item about the moron. So he said that he has never considered resigning, despite what his associates have described as deep frustration. But he did not deny a report that he's grown so disenchanted with Trump that he once referred to him as a moron. Now, I've called Trump a moron many times, so to hear this from somebody closer to the monster doesn't surprise me. So what's interesting was the things that Rex Tillerson chose to deny. The vice president has never had to persuade me to remain as Secretary of State because I have never considered leaving this post. When asked bluntly and directly if he had called Trump a moron, he said, "I'm not going to deal with petty stuff like that." And so his dodge, his omission, his refusal to deny that while he denied other aspects of the NBC report, gives added currency to what is hearsay. And I think it is emblematic, symptomatic, of the problems that will plague this administration until it craters, whether at the end of a term or through some other special means like impeachment or resignation. And so when you recap the different times when Trump has undercut his Secretary of State, I really don't have time to recount them all. But this tension grew, according to the New York Times account here, with the NBC News report that Tillerson had been ready to resign over the summer. The article said that Tillerson was particularly upset at Trump's politicized speech at the Boy Scouts of America, an organization that Tillerson used to be the head of. He was in Texas at the time for his son's wedding, and he threatened not to return to Washington, according to three people with direct knowledge of the threat. Now, once again, this is based on anonymous sources, and it is probably true. But this is what passes for journalism in the American media these days. And while I think that Tillerson's non-denial of the moron label essentially asserts or it infers that it's true, I am uncomfortable with the kind of hearsay-based reporting, the anonymous leaks, the sniping from unnamed sources that is used by the media outlets to hammer the Trump administration. So I'm hardly defending Trump, but I do recognize that the media has given itself special license. And that special license, of course, includes the Trump-Russia narrative. And as you know, I remain skeptical. I'll restate my position that I haven't seen public evidence of the Trump-Russia collusion. I haven't seen public evidence of the claim that the DNC servers were hacked by Russian operatives who then gave that information to WikiLeaks to selectively leak it in order to hurt Hillary Clinton and help Donald Trump. There simply is not enough evidence to support this narrative. Nonetheless, the two leaders, Democrat and Republican, the Dem being Mark Warner, the vice chairman, and the Republican Richard Burr, chair of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, well, they held a news conference today, and they have been pretty quiet about their investigation. We haven't heard much from them since springtime, when the House Intelligence Committee went bonkers with Devin Nunes and his secret trip to the White House and all of that bullshit. So, according to this narrative in the New York Times, American intelligence agencies have concluded that Putin initially wanted to hurt Hillary Clinton's candidacy, but later tried to explicitly help Trump's insurgent campaign. The senators said they have reached no conclusion on whether anyone around Trump was part of that effort. Burr said the issue of collusion is still open. So this leaves, again, a whole lot of fuzzy gray areas where the media narrative, again based on leaks and anonymous sources, is used as a substitute for any substantial evidence or findings from these investigations. Now, Burr says that he had hoped to wind this up by the end of the year, but because the Facebook issues have surfaced and other new leads, that appears to be doubtful. But here's a bigger quote from Burr. There is consensus among members and staff that we trust the conclusions of the intelligence community assessments. Now, I want to be clear that it's very easy to dismiss the public intelligence community assessments, the one from last October and the one from this past January. And I've spent a lot of time chewing over those. They are empty. They're devoid of any meaningful calories or information. They are based on speculation, and they leave lots of impressions, but there is nothing definitive about the public and declassified intelligence community assessments that have been released. But they have seen at the Senate Intelligence Committee, I believe, information that's not been made available to the public. And this leads to the skepticism and the distrust that people like me have of the narrative that's promoted by supporters of the Democrats and Hillary Clinton at the expense of the Trump presidency. And as you know, I believe that Trump is corrupt in many ways, and including dirty ties to people in Russia. But it hasn't been proven to my satisfaction that it was the Russian government and that it was Putin himself, as we have often heard alleged, who, you know, directed these activities. Now, Richard Burr also told the news conference, "We've got to make our facts as it related to Russia's involvement in our election before the primaries get started next year." And this is the warning that Russia will continue to try to meddle in our democratic process. Burr also told reporters that the committee had hit a wall in attempting to verify the details of the Golden Shower dossier. That's how people mostly know it. That was written by the former British intelligence officer Christopher Steele, who has rebuffed the committee's efforts to speak with him about his sources and who paid him for the compilation of the report. And Burr told the reporters, in speaking to Christopher Steele, "I can compel you to come," hinting strongly that they are preparing to issue a subpoena. But there's no mention here of the company that paid Christopher Steele, first on behalf of Republican opponents of Trump, and then on behalf of someone aligned with the Clinton campaign. That company is American. It's called Fusion GPS. They're based in Washington. They could tell you who funded it. They could tell you why they hired Christopher Steele. They could tell you how his information was delivered to them and what extent they went to verify or research the information he was sending them. But I don't hear diddly about Fusion GPS. Meanwhile, the other Senate committee that is looking into Trump activities is the Judiciary Committee. And while we don't know all the particulars, my hunch is, or my speculation, is that they're focused on obstruction of justice, the extent to which cover-ups have been run by the Trump team since the inauguration in January. And both Chuck Grassley, the Republican, and his ranking member, Dianne Feinstein, have publicly complained that they are not being permitted access to certain materials that have been shared with the Senate Intelligence Committee. So the materials that the Judiciary Committee is looking for are not specified, but Dianne Feinstein said, "We were turned down, but the issue isn't finished." And she has described the material at issue as pertaining to obstruction of justice matters that lie in the purview of the Judiciary Committee. So some turf battles have been set up. And Feinstein, of course, has had her own battles with the CIA over the torture review that she championed and that was blocked by the CIA and by the Obama administration. Now, as you know, I have just as recently as yesterday reported on the exaggerated impact of the Russian-submitted Facebook ads that were running, because we learned yesterday that only 10 million impressions were delivered. Most of the almost 500 accounts that were connected to these ads spent small amounts of money, like $3 to boost a post. The most that was spent on any one ad was $1,000. And the 10 million impressions that were delivered, 55% of them occurred after last November's election. So I'm not saying this didn't happen, but its impact has been hugely exaggerated. Now, despite that, I support the efforts by Amy Klobuchar, the senator from Minnesota, and Mark Warner from Virginia. They're both Democrats, and they are writing a bill to regulate political ads on Facebook, in Google search, in all of the photo apps like Instagram and Pinterest, and on Twitter. And I fully support this. The biggest problem is that the entity, the federal agency that enforces such regulations, is completely toothless. It is neutered because there are three Democrats and three Republicans, and they never reach a majority to move forward on penalizing people who violate existing laws, much less to make new regulations that they could enforce in the face of the changing campaign landscape. And because Facebook is so critical now for political campaign messaging, I completely support any effort to regulate the Internet services in the same manner or even more stringently than the TV broadcast stations currently are. And one of the calls is to have open public files where you and I could log on and access and find out how much Campaign X is spending on negative Facebook ads about their opponent Y, and who's looking at them, who is being targeted with these ads, and how much money is being spent. That should all be public and transparent, and I support the efforts for this kind of regulation. Every day I pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Linda Gray, Steve Wozenski, Judy Holloway, and Benny Alto. I appreciate your ongoing support. $5 a month, it adds up. And I encourage you, if you're not kicking in any bucks here and you're able, come on over to peterbcollins.com. Click on the menu button. You'll find it in the upper right-hand corner on almost any device. And when it pulls down, click on Become a Subscriber. You get to the sign-up page where you've got options, and I hope you'll choose one. And I'd love to be thanking you for your support on a podcast very soon. Now, here's an interesting bit of investigative reporting, and it took a team from The New Yorker, ProPublica, and public radio station WNYC. And they dug into a case back in 2012 where the Manhattan prosecutor, the district attorney, Cyrus Vance Jr., was leading an investigation by the Major Economic Crimes Bureau into the role of Donald Trump Jr. and his sister Ivanka, because the accusation is that they were circulating false information to prospective buyers for the Trump Soho. That's the hotel and condo development that attracted a lot of Russian investment. It's accused of being a money laundering facility for Russian money that they wanted to clean up and get into circulation in the United States. And according to this report, the siblings were worried that investigators and the press might be onto them. And there appears to be a pretty detailed email trail. According to one investigator, you couldn't have a better email trail. But after the Trump family lawyer, Mark Kasowitz, the guy who has no tact or manners whatsoever, he kicked in $25,000 to Cy Vance's reelection campaign. Kasowitz also helped Vance fundraise from others. And we aren't sure of the timeline here, so I don't want to suggest a quid pro quo when I don't have the details. But we're told that Vance then overruled his own prosecutors who wanted to keep the case alive. That's another fascinating example of the Trump corruption. But it doesn't link to Russia meddling in our election. And that, again, is what I'm waiting to see. The wrecking crew in Washington over at the Environmental Protection Agency has announced their plan to repeal the Clean Power Plan, which was an effort by the Obama administration using executive orders to regulate emissions from coal-fired power plants. And while Trump claims that he's already, boom, repealed these regulations, it doesn't really work that way. He signed an executive order in the spring saying go ahead and repeal this, but the EPA is just getting around to it now. And what is really, really crazy about this is that they are talking about a repeal and replace. And they're talking about crowdsourcing ideas for the replacement legislation. So are they going to ask Joe Sixpack, who wears a Make America Great hat? Hey, Joe, what are we going to do to, cut carbon emissions from these clean coal power plants without really using the regulations that Obama implemented? And maybe one of them will suggest that we put a stack of Make America Great hats on top of the smokestacks of these clean coal-burning power plants. We have been reduced to this level of idiocy. Now, it appears that the industry, the coal power plant operators, are pushing for some sort of replacement law because they're afraid that they're going to get sued because there is a landmark determination known as the endangerment finding, which enables the EPA, or actually requires the EPA, to regulate carbon emissions. So if the regulations from Obama are repealed, the EPA and, I guess, in turn, the power plants that it is supposed to be regulating may be vulnerable to new lawsuits. So this is another big step back in the fight to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and the impact on climate change. The Clean Power Plan under Obama was intended to reduce the effluent from power plants by 32% in the next 12 years as compared to the emission levels of 2005. I'm glad to see that not every member of the House and Senate is willing to just roll over and renew the troubling FISA Amendments Act from 2008 with its problematic Section 702. This is the section that caused Ron Wyden to ask Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, is there anything you're doing that captures the information of millions of Americans? And Clapper lied. He perjured himself. He said no. So Ron Wyden is one of many senators who are proposing legislation to place some limits on 702, to require the FBI to get a search warrant, except in national security cases. That's a huge loophole. But they're saying, look, you can't just go to this database to pick up a bank robber or somebody who's a fraudster on an interstate basis. So at least we have people who recognize the overreach of the current surveillance legislation. But Trump wants it to be permanently renewed without any changes. There's some proposals to impose the warrant requirement, to restrict renewal to 6 years or 4 years. And I'm glad to see that there is at least some discussion on this. But no matter what happens, we know that the FBI will abuse its authorities. That is their practice and their pattern, and it's why I call them a rogue agency. And let's see, here's a quote from the FBI's National Security Branch head, Carl Gattis. He said the Bureau would not risk the authority by using 702 on something that was not of critical national security importance to us. Well, I'm sorry, I don't have any data that I can directly contradict him with here, but we know that on the national security letters, which are enabled by the Patriot Act, the FBI has widely abused them. And that is based on the reports from the FBI's own Inspector General. Yesterday, we reported on the oral arguments at the Supreme Court related to redistricting or gerrymandering, the case from Wisconsin. And they also reheard arguments in a case called Jennings versus Rodriguez, which could force the government, based on a ruling from the San Francisco Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, to give immigrants the right to a bond hearing, a hearing to be released on bond while they await trial. At the moment, because it is factual that an immigrant without any papers is not covered by the constitutional rights, including the Fifth Amendment Due Process Clause. But the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals found that some people were languishing in immigrant detention centers, mostly private prisons, for as long as 3 to 5 years, without being able to make bail, without being able to get a hearing or a ruling on their status. And it appears to be a way to basically pressure people to just give up and agree to deportation. And so it's interesting to hear the commentary of Justice Stephen Breyer, who said, look, we give triple axe murderers bail hearings. Are they dangerous? Are they risk of flight? And Breyer had to, or he didn't have to, but he did apologize for raising his voice and getting a little exercised about this. But the case of Alejandro Rodriguez, which is at the basis of this class action suit, he was a legal resident here in California, picked up by Homeland Security, placed into deportation proceedings because he had previously been convicted of misdemeanor drug possession and joyriding. He was held for more than 3 years. His wife had a baby while he was in there, and he couldn't get a hearing. The backlog of immigration courts is incredible. It's now as long as 4 or 5 years. And they are trying to put more judges into that system, but it's not going to make a difference in the foreseeable future. So it does appear that the court might be able to find a right for people who actually aren't covered by the Constitution. And I'd like to see that. We continue to follow the questions that are being raised about the coverage and the narrative of Sunday night, Monday morning's mass shooting, the slaughter in Las Vegas. And Stephen Paddock, the accused gunman, his girlfriend Mary Lou Danley, returned to the United States Tuesday night, was questioned by the FBI. For some reason, she was rolled out of LAX in a wheelchair. That wasn't explained. And she is still described merely as a person of interest in the investigation. We still don't know if the money that Paddock wired to the Philippines was intended for her or reached her. And there's a lot that we don't know about what she may know about the motive of this alleged lone wolf. And I say alleged because there are still very troubling questions that come from the eyewitness testimony, from the recorded communications of police officers and others who responded to the shooting spree. And the most glaring question is, was there a second shooter? And we know that the report is that Paddock had an array of weapons converted to the ability to automatically fire repeatedly with one pull of the trigger. But there are these very serious reports of gunfire coming from windows in the hotel that were not on the 32nd floor. Some allege it was the fourth floor. Some say it was a little bit higher. There were flashes of light that some people now say, oh, that was just a strobe light. But I saw a light that appeared to be coming from a gun muzzle, picked up on an iPhone, that was in sync with the sound of gunfire, and the light was extinguished when the gunfire stopped. Now, again, I don't have enough evidence here, and I'm not in a position to thoroughly investigate many of these questions that can get kind of technical. But over at the website Zero Hedge, which is typically a pro-Trump outlet, Tyler Durden published a piece that he attributes to a man who's running for Congress in Idaho, a Republican candidate named Michael Snyder. And Snyder made a list of 16 questions. Some of them I don't think are very important, but some of them are. For example, his number one question is of photos that have been leaked of the Paddock hotel room show what appears to be a suicide note. Why hasn't the public been told what's in that note? Then the number two question I covered already, were there additional shooters? A taxi driver reportedly captured video of an automatic weapon being fired out of a lower-level window. A video from another angle and a brief footage captured by a guy also seemed to confirm that automatic gunfire was coming from a floor much lower than the 32nd. Why were law enforcement authorities discussing another suspect on the fourth floor? Why isn't the mainstream media talking about it? Others have quibbled with the number of shots fired in the elapsed time of the shooting event. And some people have used a duration of 4 to 5 minutes when the most common report is 9 to 11 minutes. Again, I have not had the ability to investigate this independently. He asks, how did Paddock get 42 guns into his hotel room and without anybody noticing? We covered that yesterday because of the almost weekly gun shows that occur at these big casino hotels in Las Vegas. Number six, how did someone with no military background and who wasn't a gun guy operate such advanced weapons? Let's see what else. Why was one woman at the concert telling people in the crowd they were all going to die 45 minutes before the bullets started flying? I've heard that report. It's troubling. Why did it take law enforcement authorities 72 minutes to get into Paddock's hotel room? Now, I heard the deputy sheriff from Las Vegas, Clark County, on television last night dodging that question. And it should be very easy for them to figure out exactly what time they actually broke down the door and entered the room. And 72 minutes deserves an explanation. Because, they said, well, he had stopped firing, so the immediate crisis was over, and we were treating it as someone who was barricaded in the room. It doesn't add up. Then questions about Mary Lou Danley. Why was the Islamic State so eager to take responsibility, and why the FBI so quick to dismiss that? The second, I think, is more relevant than the first. And the last question I'll cite here is why were nearly all of the exits out of the concert venue completely blocked? If you find any information that you think is compelling, please email peter@peterbcollins.com. I'd like to know about it. And if I find it valid and interesting, I will share it with our listeners. Well, yesterday Trump went to Puerto Rico, and he left a bunch of his golden turds behind. Yesterday we talked about how he compared the death count in Puerto Rico and said it wasn't a real catastrophe like Katrina. Well, the death count actually doubled, more than doubled from 16 to 34 just in the last 24 hours. Now, it doesn't compare to the 1,800 fatalities from Hurricane Katrina. That is accurate. But it is so insensitive and just downright moronic to go to Puerto Rico and then tell people, your catastrophe wasn't as bad as Katrina. I'm sorry. That is just, well, as Rex Tillerson would say, that is what a moron would say. He also, you may have seen the footage where he was in a room with some people who've been displaced by the hurricane, and he started tossing out rolls of paper towels like it was a game. And then there's a case where he talked to a couple who are homeless now and ended up by telling them to have a good time. And then there was the awkward handshake with the mayor of San Juan that Trump has been bitterly tweeting at, Carmen Yulin Cruz, who went up to him, and as he tried to backpedal quickly, she said, "It's not about politics, it's about saving lives." And Trump had implicitly criticized her by praising the governor of Puerto Rico, who he said didn't use politics in the discussion of the bungled response to this natural disaster. And finally today, temperatures seem to be lowering in the struggle between the Kurds, the government in Baghdad, the Turks, and to some extent the nation of Iran, because it's been more than a week since the Kurdish independence vote was announced, and Baghdad has done just about nothing to make good on its threats. Kurdish oil is still flowing despite threats by the Turks to shut down a vital pipeline. The Kurds' Peshmerga forces are still fighting along the American-led military in Iraq. The borders have not been closed. The military maneuvers by Turkey and Iran have been viewed as little more than posturing. And the flights that were banned on Friday have quietly resumed, at least to some extent, in the last few days. We'll be watching this carefully, along with the effort for Catalonia to secede from Spain with its declaration of independence, in upcoming podcasts. Thanks for joining me for my news and comment blast today. As usual, I'll be posting this on YouTube, and I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until